Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I'm joined by Blake Masters, the Chief Operations Officer of Teal Capital, President of the Teal Foundation. He's also running for Senate in Arizona in the 2022 election against Mark Kelly. Is that accurate?
That is right.
Where is the best place for people to find where you stand on the issues and your website?
Just blakemasters.com.
The government is justified in mandating lockdowns and vaccines to stop the spread of a deadly virus. How do you respond?
Not this virus. You can imagine if COVID were like 1,000 times worse or was the bubonic plague or something. But we have so much data on this now. We know it's, you know, the flu or 2 to 3 times worse than the flu. It's no picnic. You don't want COVID. But I really think if we surrender all of our civil liberties, all of our personal freedoms to the public health bureaucracy, not only is that not warranted here, we'll just never get those freedoms back.
You're a supporter of the right to bear arms to fight against tyranny. What metric can we use to determine whether or not tyranny exists in America?
I mean, I think you have to use every metric, right? It's not just about tax rates, although if a lot of people are paying more than half their income to the government every year, that's not a good sign, right? It's not just about lockdowns, although, yeah, if the government can arbitrarily close your business at any time or arbitrarily enforce, you know, curfews, stay-at-home orders, all of a sudden we start to look a lot more like Australia, you know, which is having the military and police basically enforce stay-at-home quarantine orders on people. It's not just, you know, can you speak your mind freely in the public square or in the new digital equivalents like Twitter and Facebook? But we're seeing increasingly, no, you're not allowed to speak your mind in all these places. You'll get censored and canceled and, you know, all this stuff. So there's no one metric, but I don't think we're kind of, when you take a totality of the circumstances approach, I don't think we're doing so hot on this. I think it's we're sliding in that direction for sure.
Is there a general philosophy or set of ideas that guides your decision making?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a conservative person with libertarian instincts. I probably used to be a lot more libertarian than I am now. The one sort of animating force behind all my political thinking is, as early as I can remember, that's never changed, is this sense of anti-progressivism. I think progressivism, capital P, as a political ideology, is toxic. I view it as corrosive. I think it corrupts almost everything it touches. I think it's, you know, it wants to throw out all of our history. It wants to throw out everything real that our ancestors built. It's basically the ideology of Bolshevism, you know, and just communist revolution. And it may look a little different today, but I think it's no less dangerous. And so I think the progressive capital P answer is sort of always the wrong one. As conservatives, as libertarians, we want progress in society. You want things to get better and better. But you do that, you know, almost slowly, more humbly over time by doing the right thing, by making investments in the future. You don't do it with this sort of burn it all down revolutionary mindset.
Sure. There's a quote from a book, Hate Incorporated, by Matt Taibbi. He says, so long as the public is busy hating each other and not aiming its ire at the more complex financial and political processes going off camera, there's very little danger of anything like a popular uprising. Is that your read on the situation, that we are experiencing some sort of bread and circuses and false divide amongst the populace?
I think so. I mean, I do think that's what the sort of elite or establishment is up to when, for instance, they just try to stoke the flames of racial division. You know, stuff almost seems astroturf and engineered to divide people. I think most white people are good people. I think most black people are good people. I think there's, you know, some people who aren't so good, or who let the evil in themselves predominate sort of from every category. But I think most people want to get along, right? And America is this grand experiment. And can we all have rights? Can we all have freedoms? Can we all get along, even though, you know, we don't all have the same background. And so when I see this media elite, and when I see a political elite that wants to zoom in on and obsess about, you know, alleged differences between people and sort of fan the flames and get people to hate each other, and, you know, it's this political interest group versus that, and you start this identity politics stuff, like, it doesn't seem very natural to me. It seems like it is what the elite wants us to focus on, whether it's some grand conspiracy, you know, to distract everybody from what's really going on, or whether that's just functionally how the fault lines of our modern politics go. I think it's some kind of intentional strategy, and I think it's bad. I think most people just want to get along and they want to focus on real problems. And we don't do that if we're just focused on, you know, I'd say identity politics.
What do you think about this claim? The masses in every nation are, by every metric, rationally ignorant about politics. We need less people voting, not more. What do you say to that?
Well, I want more people voting if and only if they're, like, you know, informed and know what's going on. I'd rather have fewer people vote, but have those votes, you know, sort of be informed and intelligent than just more people. So that we need to get more people voting no matter what thing. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think you want more people to vote and you want more people to be informed. And ideally those go together. In practice, I think with ballot harvesting and a lot of the Democrat operative tricks, they don't want them to go together. They just want the raw number of votes because it gives them more ammo. But no, I think what ultimately matters is, like, do you have the right policies in place? Do you have policies in place that are going to, you know, protect private property rights, that are going to keep people free and safe, but also kind of create the conditions under which businesses and families can thrive? And, you know, if voters are voting for tyranny, like, all of a sudden, voting's not so good, is it? You know, if voters are voting for politicians and policies that are actually keeping people free while keeping them safe, then I think that's good. So I do think the left just makes too much of raw democracy, raw votes. And I think we need to focus on making sure that our public is educated, making sure that people are actually thinking about politics in a substantive way, because just the proceduralism of mere casting votes is not going to save us.
Antonin Scalia famously said, "The transformation of charity into legal entitlement has produced donors without love and recipients without gratitude." What is your position on this statement and the welfare state in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to Aristotle, if I'm not mistaken, right? Like, if you force someone to make a choice, say I come with a gun and I, you know, demand taxes from you, and I take that tax revenue and then I give it to somebody in, like, kind of a welfare program, have you done a moral act of goodness by, you know, having your money end up in the recipient's hands? No, because it wasn't a choice. And so I do think that, you know, to a first approximation, charity is better than welfare. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't have a safety net in society. I think we should. But I also think our welfare system is probably terribly bloated. Right now in the Biden economy, we're seeing actually businesses struggle. We're struggling to restart the economy because the unemployment benefits, when combined with the stimulus checks that people got during COVID, were so high as to keep a lot of people sort of at work, you know, out of work and on the dole. And I think that's bad. I think people should work if they can. I think we need to incentivize people to work. And then you do need some safety net, you know, when people slip through the cracks. But the idea is you bounce back and you can reenter society. And too much of our welfare program, you know, this stuff becomes institutionalized and it becomes bureaucratic and sclerotic, and it's very hard to pare it down or get rid of it. And so I think what the left wants to do is keep people on the dole. You know, the left, they don't want a healthy middle class where people are looking out for themselves. They want a thin slice of elite at the top that they get to control. They want a hollowed out middle class, and then they want an underclass, like a permanent underclass of people on the dole, whether that's welfare as we know it, whether that's UBI or stimulus checks. They want a whole host of the populace, you know, basically just dependent on their good graces. I think that's how left-wing politics works.
When we look at the political spectrum in general, if we just take Biden, I'm sure this applies to almost all previous presidents, but he does not run his Twitter account, if you follow it. That's certainly not his words. He's got a lot of speech writers. On multiple occasions, he's referred to his notes in Q&A press conferences saying, "I have a list of who to call on here." Right. And it's not like he writes the laws. So who is in charge in Washington, D.C.? Who calls the shots there?
It's a fascinating question, right? Where is the seat of power in our own government? And, you know, I mean, I still think the president and the presidency is pretty powerful, but Biden, I think, with his advanced age. And unfortunately, I think, obviously, you know, sort of mental incapacitation raises that question, right? It's not him making the decisions. Is it the staff around him? You know, I don't think it's Obama just puppeteering everything. I hear that a lot, although I'm sure he's not without influence. I think it's diffuse. And I also think that's dangerous. I think there's a permanent bureaucracy. You know, there's the sort of the temporary staff in the White House that's sort of managing Biden, handling him, so to speak. But there's a permanent bureaucracy in D.C., you know, parts of the civil service that we can see, and I'm sure some parts that we can't. And I think that's a problem because this is a bureaucracy, I think, that goes left wing, especially over time. And I think they're pretty hostile to the ever-flowing changes in electoral politics. And I think that's a big problem. You know, the answer should clearly be what's laid out in the constitutional design. The president has this set of power, Congress has this set of power, everything else is reserved to the states. And instead, I think we know the power resides in DC, partly it's the president, and I still think Congress is, you know, they have some degree of power, although they don't seem to like to use it. And that just kind of means whoever's got it, it's murky, it might be diffuse, it's not transparent, and I don't think it's being wielded well or wisely for the American people.
So many people were humbled after they saw the results of the 2016 election and after the 2020 election. There was a lot of humility among people saying that Trump's black votes increased after 4 years of the media on top of him. What are some main lessons we can learn from 2016, Trump, and the 2020 election specifically?
Yeah, I think Trump, I mean, he came on the scene and busted up the establishment in 2016. You know, he was saying this left-wing establishment does not work, and this center-right, you know, Republican establishment, it doesn't work. I think we had decades of bipartisan failure to get us to that point. But Trump was able to come along and say true things that sort of everybody knew and felt were true, but you weren't quite allowed to articulate because they contravened the CNN or the MSNBC narrative. You know, Trump was one of the first candidates to stand on stage and say, like, I think the Iraq war was a giant mistake. And he defended that. And that was where the American people were, but that wasn't where the politicians were. And so I think there was a tremendous amount of bravery and good timing. And he just came and you could just tell, right? He was saying what he thought. He wasn't trying to listen to consultants and just give bullet points. He was actually just gonna speak his mind. And so whether or not people agreed with him or disagreed with him, it was just so refreshing, I think, to hear a politician, someone running for president, who he didn't need to be doing what he was doing. And he was clearly being honest. And I think that's why he took everybody by surprise, because we just had a shockingly low amount of honesty in the system. And then 2020, you know, I think a lot of the powers that be that were surprised in 2016, they knew President Trump was the president and they didn't want to be surprised again. And so I really, you know, you look at the obvious censorship that Facebook exhibited leading up to 2020. I mean, I think just 3 weeks before the election, right? Hunter Biden and the laptop story from the New York Post, Facebook just ripped it off the platform. I think, again, Facebook, you know, they got criticized in 2016 for not doing enough to stop, you know, the Trump campaign. And so I think they massively overcorrected and censored the hell out of that story and more or less handed the election to Biden when they did that. So that was the 2020 election was a mess in many different ways. But I think one lesson is you come along, you say true things that very few people have heard, even though everybody intuits them to be true, powerful stuff. And then that pisses off powerful people. And I think Trump had a lot of enemies in 2020 that took him deadly seriously, whereas in 2016, they were just laughing.
Yeah, certainly. He said that his comments about the Iraq war were in South Carolina to Jeb Bush. So it's not like, you know, he said it in California as like, you know, some softball to the crowd. He actually really stood up. And I remember Russia Gate 2.0 in 2020 when Politico said 50 intelligence officers have confirmed that the Hunter Biden story is Russian disinformation. Now, when you face something like that, and in 2016, the lie was 17 intelligence agencies had confirmed it. Hillary Clinton said this on the debate stage, 80 million people watching, but they never saw the June 29th, 2017 retraction by the New York Times. How is it that we can get people to stop seeing the news as a source of truth and see them as we would see tobacco executives?
It's a great question. You know, I think it's happening. I mean, not to be too optimistic about this, but I think one of the greatest gifts that Trump did give us is he massively delegitimated the mainstream media, you know, which I think was bad for a while before 2016. But it wasn't until you had a guy brave enough to go and basically win and then do battle with the mainstream media like every day for 4 years, which he really did. And so, yeah, CNN still exists. MSNBC still exists. Too many people watch them, unfortunately. If that's all you watch, I really do think like your mind turns to mush. So that's not great. But I also think now more than ever, especially, you know, 1 or 2 years into this, you know, so-called, whatever you want to call it, COVID pandemic, that the left never wants to admit, you know, has ended or will end. People know that like the official sources, right, the media, Dr. Fauci, the public health bureaucracy, the official sources more often than not get it wrong, and they're all too happy to lie to you. You know, these things have functionally become extensions of the Democratic Party. And so I do think that the amount of skepticism now is higher than ever, and that's good. You know, maybe it's tough because, you know, it's hard to know what's true, and we live in this crazy information warfare environment, and maybe you can't just accept one outlet's reporting as gospel, but maybe you never could. Right. And now this is a little bit more transparent and public, and people have to piece together information and decide and think for themselves. And I think in a republic, that's really healthy, even if it feels kind of crazy right now.
Assume that poverty is my biggest issue. We can forget about relative inequality. If I just care about absolute poverty in Arizona, why should I vote Masters instead of Kelly?
Well, I think Kelly and the whole Democratic regime are interested in keeping people down while promising to lift them up. You know, again, that's the sort of electoral strategy of the left. I actually just want as many people to rise up into the middle class as possible. I think in America, you ought to be able to afford to raise a family on one single income. And if most people can do that, you know, we used to have an economy where that was possible, and then that's not really possible anymore. So I think it's an interesting question, like what happened and why, and can we reverse that? But that's really what I care about. Can the average person look forward to a well-paying job, and can they look forward to buying a house, getting married, and having kids? And that's the litmus test. It's like if your society is delivering that to people while, you know, still being sort of respectful of people's liberties and basic, you know, right to be safe and secure, then I think you're winning. And I don't think the Democrats are interested in that, which is why they shriek so much every time I say that. They're interested in making sure people are running as hard and hard on the treadmill as possible just to stay in the same place while they call Republicans evil so that they can control people. So I think it's just right there in the economic policies. You know, you could get into all sorts of cultural stuff, but like right there in the economic policies, I want people to rise into the middle class and have a set of economic policies that I think actually makes that happen. The Dems don't want to do anything. They just want to give people checks occasionally so that they continue to vote Democrat and keep people down.
Well, even Paul Krugman has admitted that this is a pattern going back to Otto von Bismarck, ushering in this welfare state to secure the rule of the Kaiser. So some might say, well, the Kaiser's illegitimate, but then again, half my income's reliant on them, so this is probably as good as it's going to get. So it almost stops them from seeing the state or the regime as more legitimate than they otherwise would. A lot of people are worried about inflation, which I'm just glad that people are noticing it. Do you have any theory as to what causes inflation and what the cure might be?
Well, I mean, it can be a complicated question, some of the details, but I think the simple answer is printing money, right? By definition, I think, you know, creates inflation, right? We're just expanding the money supply and diluting the value of a dollar. And usually you can get away with that if you do it slowly enough, right? I think the dollar's lost like 98% of its purchasing power since, you know, 1913 or whatever. But when you print $5 or $6 trillion in the last 18 months, like the federal government has done, this is what happens. So this seems like a clear-cut example. I think it is Biden's policies at this point. They'll try to blame Trump, but Again, maybe some of the early stimulus stuff was necessary if you were going to lock people down. We shouldn't have had any of the lockdowns, but given that we did, you know, sort of mid-2020, you know, that was an emergency, or we thought it was an emergency. But then you can't keep doing it for like the next year. Biden, you know, was sending stimulus checks out as late as summer of 2021. And when you do that, when you print trillions and trillions of dollars, like, you should expect to see some inflation. And so I think, unfortunately, all the inflation that we're seeing now, we're just getting started. I think it's going to get a lot worse.
One of the great contradictions of the progressive worldview is we have someone like, you know, Woodrow Wilson, or even Teddy Roosevelt, as Glenn Beck has argued, was a progressive for his time. They'll say monopolies are terrible. If you have a monopoly, you get worse quality and higher prices than you otherwise would. Also, government needs to monopolize the money supply. Well, in that sense, you're going probably to get worse quality and a lower purchasing power than you otherwise would. What do you think about things like cryptocurrency or Bitcoin as alternatives that people can do to hedge themselves? I'm asking the president of Teal Capital for a reason. What else can we do to fight against inflation? Please work cryptocurrency into the answer.
Yeah, I think I'm pro cryptocurrency. I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating at the technological level. I think it's fascinating at the monetary level. And I've been into it for a number of years. So I totally support crypto. I don't think the government should look to ban it or anything like that. I do think, you know, there's ways to spin it where, you know, Bitcoin's really bad for the US dollar, and this is existential, and this is a threat to the regime or whatever. And this is kind of the line that you see from Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren. You know, I think they're fearful. They like their government monopoly money supply, right? And they're fearful of anything that might disrupt it. I would just disagree with them, I think, but I have a different take where I think Bitcoin could be the best check that we have on the Fed. Like, it could actually help the dollar, because right now, right, we just have a completely undisciplined monetary policy. Whenever politicians can sell it, or whenever the Fed can do it, you know, they have the capacity, and they actually do just print trillions of dollars. You know, just they create new money. And that has the effect of diluting everyone else's savings. It's basically just taxation by another means, right? And they can do that because of this monopoly dynamic that you articulated, because it's not there's no free and open exchange. The dollar is the reserve currency of the world. You know, all debts are denominated in dollars in the United States, and you have to pay your taxes in dollars. So there's no way out of the system, and they can make the system worse and worse. With Bitcoin, and the technological inability to ban it, I think, you know, it may actually do what gold was supposed to do. It may just be this safe haven. You know, there's 21 million Bitcoin. Assume one or two are lost forever, so there's only 19 million. You can never make more. It's the hardest money imaginable. And so if the government knows that Bitcoin exists, which obviously it does, maybe in the next 10 years, they won't be able to get away with printing as much. Right? Maybe people will invest your smart money, big money, a lot bigger than what we've seen so far, will just flock to Bitcoin. And when you have an uncancelable, you know, digital money that's just super hard, I think it really could impose a sense of discipline on the Fed that basically nothing has been able to in the last 100 years. So I'm a little bit more optimistic. Certainly from the individual's perspective, I think it's a godsend. You know, like, if you just keep your money in a savings account earning less than 1% a year, you're going to get destroyed by inflation. If you keep some of it in Bitcoin as a hedge, I think that is an innovation that's now accessible to you that wasn't 10 years ago. And I think that's amazing. I think it's just good for individual investors.
The PhD economist Thomas Sowell wrote, "In reality, most of the great fortunes in American history have resulted from someone's figuring out how to reduce costs so as to be able to charge lower prices and therefore gain a mass market for the product. Henry Ford did this with automobiles, Rockefeller with oil, Carnegie with steel, and Sears, Penny, Walton, and other department store chains founders with a variety of products." How can we take this lesson, apply it to the healthcare industry, and have affordable healthcare for all Americans?
Totally. And you start by asking that question, which I don't think too many policymakers do. I think people have basically internalized this view where the costs of everyday essentials, healthcare, housing, education, just get more and more expensive every year, right? We tend to assume that because that's been the case for 40 or 50 years, this is some iron law of physics, but it's not. And you've seen other industries that you mentioned, right? Certainly IT or flat screen TVs, like the costs of these things, they just go down every year. And the quality goes up, and that's a pretty consumer, you know, friendly ratio. Healthcare, you know, there's some ways to spin it where the quality goes up every year. Actually, I think it's pretty flat, but certainly the costs are rising astronomically relative to what we get. Same thing in education. And when you look at the healthcare industry, or you look at the you know, education, higher education, what you see is a lot of cartel-like organization. You see a lot of giant consolidation, you know, in hospital systems. In pharmaceutical companies, you see a lot of regulatory capture, where a lot of the people running these companies used to work in the government, or you know, maybe soon will, and there's this revolving door, and you get legislation sort of written to protect giant incumbents and keep out startup entrants. And I think we have to go in and you know, part of it's deregulation, part of it is just hacking away at some of the corruption and the waste and the over-consolidation, and figuring out what's a more lightweight regulatory footprint we can take and get prices back. You know, the biggest problem with healthcare and the costs in America is that the costs are totally opaque. And so if I'm a consumer of healthcare, but I'm never interacting with prices, you know, it's just some Byzantine process where at the end I get some bill that I can't understand. That's bad. It's bad to have a system where a knee MRI can cost $600 or, you know, $15,000, just depending on the arbitrary, you know, flow of where did I get the procedure in town, and, you know, who is the attending physician, and what have they negotiated with which insurer. You know, like, that doesn't make sense at all. And so I think deregulating quite a bit, taking away some of the protections enjoyed by incumbents, making it much more open and competitive, and getting pricing back into the system, like real market pricing, I think is just obviously the way to do it.
Yeah, I really like that answer, because if you look at, you can almost just take their arguments and just apply it to a different field. So they'll say, if you need so much as a driver's license to vote, millions of people will not be able to have access to voting. It's like, okay, what if you need hundreds of licenses to just start a business, and then more licenses to trade, and then you're constantly getting audited by OSHA and everyone else? Well, those regulations hurt those in lower income brackets more than, I mean, Walmart's not sweating that OSHA's coming around, but everyone else is, and the Department of Agriculture. So thank you for prioritizing that. Elon Musk recently said that IP legislation needs total reform, and that's why he is making all his patents open source. Do you think there's anything in that area that we can do to, you know, have a more environmentally friendly products and services?
Yeah, I mean, the patent stuff is interesting, right? It's right there in the Constitution. But of course, how it's actually implemented and administrated is a question for policymakers today. Yeah, I'm not sure about the IP regime. You know, people critique it from all different ways. I'd want to take a fresh look at it. I do think, in general, we're just drowning in bureaucracy as a society. Everything is overregulated. This is not to say we shouldn't have any regulation. I mean, I think we can and we should. But I do think everything is, and I do almost mean everything, is overregulated, over-administered, over-bureaucratized. And so it's actually just really hard for individuals to exert agency in our system. And you have some Herculean type entrepreneur folks like Elon Musk, you know, who's able to sort of break through and actually create new and world-changing companies. But his appetite for risk is, you know, one in a billion. And were it not for him, and I think Jeff Bezos too, but mainly Elon, you know, we wouldn't be able to send astronauts up into space on an American aircraft, because the government, with a giant budget, many, many times Elon's budget at SpaceX, you know, basically was unable to innovate and unable to build a next generation rocket and human delivery system. So we know that most great advances come from the private sector. We know most great advances come from the in the form of like a actually sort of a lone individual driving a business or driving a scientific discovery. But in the modern world, we've become so bureaucratized and we throw so many onerous regulations at people, so many hurdles that they have to jump over. We're just getting fewer and fewer of those breakthrough innovations. And I think the result is a much more stagnant society that looks a lot more like Europe now, right? It's just managed decline. And then becomes cultural. People stop feeling like they have a sense of agency, like they might actually participate and do something great, so they don't try. And then it just becomes this feedback loop. And I think that's how a rich society becomes decadent and an unproductive. And before long, it gets sort of eaten alive from the inside.
I love your idea about being able to live and raise a family off one income. The economics that I've studied was mostly at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Alabama. My general understanding is that in order to get real wage increases, you would want competition to allow wages to be bid up, and at the same time have a free market of capital investment, which allows each individual worker to become more productive over time, while you have people competing for products and services to get lower in price, is how real wages will grow over time. What are your thoughts on that, and how can we make it so we can have this idea of yours of one income per family?
Yeah, I mean, I basically think that approach is right. You need wages to rise and you need costs to fall. Costs are falling in some things, as we've discussed. You know, your TV's cheaper, your toaster's cheaper than it was 5 or 10 years ago. And that's not trivial, that's not bad, but your TV was never a big part of your budget anyway. Your house, your education, your kids' education, healthcare, those are the drivers, and those costs are rising so much faster than inflation even, and that's a problem, right? It means that if you don't have massive wage growth, and if anything, we're contracting now, I think wages are down 2% under Biden, then you're just, it's not even running harder to stay in the same place. Your quality of life is actually just declining every year, which I think is what millions of Americans, tens of millions, are unfortunately experiencing now. So you need wages to rise, you need costs to fall. The costs we've discussed a little bit. I think you can go and attack some of the concentration, the regulatory structures behind, especially healthcare and education to an extent, in housing with zoning and all that. I meet with so many home builders and they're ready to go. You know, they know how to build homes. We're so much more efficient at moving earth and big materials now than we were a couple decades ago, but houses cost more and more, mainly because the environmental and regulatory review stuff, it's just crazy. So I think we could do a lot with the political will to attack those costs. Wages to rise, you know, part of this is the education system that we have in our country. It's so bad. You know, we pretend that everybody has to go to a four-year liberal arts school or get a four-year, you know, BS or BA. I just don't think that's true. I think we should be recognizing most people shouldn't go to college. There should be like 1,000 different paths to the middle class, not just one. And we need to more heavily actually invest in vocational training, you know, actually start working with kids, working with 12-year-olds, you know, 16-year-olds should know how to hang drywall. You know, you might do something very different in your life, but like there's no reason why you should sit in a room, you know, from kindergarten to 12th grade and basically only receive a certain kind of, you know, mostly political and mostly not even that great academic education without actually learning skills that might, you know, translate to the workforce. So there's that. You know, in general, I'm totally with you. Free markets and capital, so people can attract investment, so people can invest in productive projects. I am a fan of tariffs to equalize a playing field, say between the United States and China. Like, I don't think there's any free trade with China. Whatever we call free trade with China is usually just us not doing anything. And then China, with the way that society is, right? Communist, totalitarian dictatorship. So they've got their thumb on the scale. They're subsidizing state industry. They're going to dump steel onto the US. And in theory, that's good for some consumers. And in practice, I think it devastates domestic manufacturing. So I'm in favor of tariffs to the extent they equalize the playing field. But after that, I want as much free trade as possible. And I think if you get government out of the way, wages rise as you get technological development and each worker becomes marginally more productive. Like, we know how this works, and so it's so frustrating to have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of congressmen and probably 90 senators not understand this stuff.
Why does the left keep winning?
I think they're deadly serious about winning. I think the right is not, to a first approximation. There's some problem with the view of American exceptionalism here, where the right just thinks like, oh, America's the best country that has ever existed, which is true. But if you only think that and you forget that every generation we have to put in the work and renew our institutions, keep them working, right? Keep this vision of a good society, make sure basically that things are in order. If you don't actually do that hard work, you'll lose it. And what was once the greatest country in the world will fall. And the left, you know, I think their agenda is ghastly, you know, open borders and all these social movements that I think are divisive. We talked about some of the racial agitation that I think they do, Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. I don't agree with the agenda, but I do at least acknowledge that they work hard to achieve it. Every day, I think the left is obsessed with taking one more centimeter, with just getting into our institutions and taking them over. And I think all the right has wanted to do for decades is play defense. And we're very good at saying like, oh, don't do that. That's unconstitutional, or that's illegal, or that's bad. But it's like, what do we do about it? And if you're not actually interested in using power intelligently and wisely and in going on offense, then I think you just lose. I think the left plays to win, and that's something that we need to learn from.
I went to a lot of school board meetings in Scottsdale and Chandler and Phoenix after Ducey was elected, and the I don't know what other word besides entitlement to use was the general feeling that I got amongst the teachers there and their supporters. Their default position is we're entitled to billions of dollars of other people's money, and it either works or it needs more funding. There's no, we need new management, right, or we need vouchers, or we need to give people the option to opt out of funding the schools, just as you would have the choice to opt out of funding the Catholic schools. Right. What do you do with such a corrupt and divisive schooling system? I can't even call it education.
Right. Well, look, I think there are many, many, many great teachers out there. And
yes,
teachers' unions are horrible. And it used to be that, you know, you weren't able to say both of those things, because if you said the second, if you say teachers' unions are horrible, you're somehow anti-teacher. And I think that was true even just 5 years ago, but now it's not true. Now I think everybody acknowledges this. The teachers' unions have moved so far left so fast, and they've been so transparently, entitled, frankly, and anti-child in their fundamental orientation. Just look at how they handled the COVID pandemic. That I think most parents and most voters now know these institutions exist to protect themselves, you know, to grow. And it's not about delivering the best education for the child, even though that may well be what's in the heart of most individual teachers. And so I think distinguishing between teachers and the teachers' unions is very important right now, because I do think the right needs to make war on the teachers' unions. You know, they're teaching kids, or they're seeking to teach kids, all sorts of toxic sort of left wing, I think increasingly race-based ideology, and that's bad. But even if you wipe that stuff away, like the education system itself, like the quality of the schooling has just been going down. It's been failing for a long time. We're graduating kids that can't even read or write. And, you know, the solution is always just lower standards, And then look how much higher graduation rate is since we made it easier to graduate. Well, that's actually horrible. It's horrible for the kids, right? I think you got to set the bar high and tell kids to jump and go get it and give them the support that they need to do that. But that spirit of achievement, I think, is lacking in so many of the schools. And you're right. The answer is always more money, and more money just makes a bad system even worse. And there's something paradoxical in there. And I think we see that clearly, but the left still doesn't see it. I think in Arizona, we spend north of $11,000 or $12,000 per student in the public school system to educate a child for a whole year. And it's just crazy. You know, first of all, half that money probably stays outside of the classroom and goes to administrators. You know, the ranks of the administration is just swelling as they're hiring diversity and equity and inclusion consultants and all this crap. But I think you, I mean, you can clearly educate a child for $3,000 or $4,000 a year. I mean, 100 years ago, people did it for a lot less, and the quality of the education was just way better. Go look at an entrance exam, you know, to a high school or to a, you know, to a college from like 1908. And there's nothing special about those kids. They weren't geniuses, but they were disciplined, and the schools worked, and the teachers were serious and empowered to actually get results from the students. So I don't know, maybe it's as simple as starting by banning teachers unions. Like, I'm not sure you should be allowed to unionize against the taxpayer or to unionize against children, which I think is what the teachers unions do.
About a year ago, it was terrible to assume that someone as high up in government as Anthony Fauci would ever lie or be self-interested or not care to give people the truth. And then one of many videos went around, primarily the 60 Minutes one in March of 2020, where he said people shouldn't be wearing masks. In fact, sometimes you can end up touching your face and it's worse than it otherwise would be. He also said, he had dismissed the lab leak theory. He had said schools need to stay closed. He had said that no prior pandemic has ever spread from asymptomatic people, so that's nothing we have to worry about. After all this, the response was, well, sometimes you have to lie to the idiot masses because there's people who just won't, who if you tell them the truth, they quite literally cannot handle it. How do you communicate to that mindset that the elites are either right and justified or, for God's sakes, we just need them? Either way, the left stays in power.
You know, it's just really sad. I think Fauci's behavior is criminal. I do. For the longest time, I wanted to think he was simply incompetent, you know, a bureaucrat who'd lost his edge because he was out of industry for a while. But when you look at, like, now we have enough data, right? We've got many months of pandemic under our belt with him at the helm. And you look at the false statements, you look at the omissions, you look at the outright lies, the smugness too, with, you know, that he carries on with. Makes it sort of particularly revolting. But I do, just on the lab leak stuff alone, like, he testified to Congress that, you know, we didn't fund the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And then, like, we actually know that, no, his, you know, his team via the EcoHealth Alliance and NIH grants and whatnot, like, we were involved in funding that research. And I think that one lie alone, like, he should be investigated. I mean, he should obviously be fired on day one. He should be investigated. And if he was actually, you know, found guilty of lying, he should be prosecuted. But it's not going to happen because we have no accountability for our elites. We just don't. It's disgusting. He can lie with impunity. And I do think that Dr. Fauci himself was responsible for the deaths of untold people in this pandemic. Like, he gives the wrong advice. It's politically motivated. I think it's killing a lot of people. I really do.
Thank you so much for being generous with your time. I have two more questions for you. I want to get your response to this statement. When Antifa and BLM riot, they intimidate powerless, innocent people. The January 6th rioters intimidated the most evil people in the country who are also the most powerful. There is no moral equivalence. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't really think there is a moral equivalent. I mean, I don't. I think people were allowed to burn cities down and riot and loot with impunity, right, in the summer of 2020. And nothing happened to them. And in the off chance they were arrested, right, then candidate for vice president, Senator Kamala Harris, was ready to bail them out. And so that contrast between all those people, right, if you're left wing, you can commit whatever sort of violence you want. Maybe the system will come down on you, but it'll treat you with kid gloves. But if you stepped over that line onto the Capitol property, I mean, the FBI is still hunting for people, you know, January 6th defendants. And we've heard some of the horrible stories about these people being in solitary confinement, you know, denied proper access to counsel, truly barbaric conditions for what weren't violent crimes. You know, I think the Arizona-based, they call him the Q Shaman or whatever with the Viking horns, that guy got 41 months in jail. 41 months when he clearly just needs some, you know, some mental health resources, some therapy, something, you know, some community service. You know, I'm not condoning trespassing. I don't think you should trespass and disrupt Congress when they're trying to do something. But you look at a lot of the video clips too. Yeah, some people were pushing, you know, police, and you shouldn't do that, and you should be held accountable. I don't think it's 41 months in jail. But certainly, like, that guy wasn't even charged with a violent crime. Like, he was just there as a trespasser. And that's not good, but the repercussion has been so disproportionate. And I think too few elected officials are willing to speak on this. I really find it disgraceful, and it's only possible in an FBI and a DOJ that's just been completely weaponized and taken over by the left. So I think it's basically day one stuff for the next strong Republican president in 2024 to clean house at the FBI and DOJ. Because once they're allowed to do this, once they're allowed to turn a blind eye to basically anarcho-tyranny and all the crimes that we saw that BLM and Antifa can do, and then just come down hard on somebody because a pro-Trump protest got out of hand, I think if you let that kind of gap persist, pretty soon the rule of law is gone, and then it's just mob rule.
Yeah, excellent points. But my final thing, this one is the most important to me, just because I run into it the most often. On my screen here, I have victims of police killing. Now, men, while 50% of the population are over 95%, this does not mean that men are discriminated against because they have different behaviors. So when I see that blacks represent a disproportionate amount of killings, I don't, you know, exactly join BLM because I know that there are different rates of crime. Even when you look at interracial crime, black on white violence tends to be about 10 to 20 times higher than white on black violence, according to a 2018 survey by the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the National Crime Victimization Survey. Even AOC and Ayanna Pressley's claim that white supremacy is everywhere. Whites, according to the U.S. Census of 2018, are about the 14th highest income after Indian, Taiwanese, Chinese, Korean, Cambodian, etc. And of course, we never hear about these people. Tony Timpa, Kelly Thomas, Ashley Babbitt, Margarita Brooks, Justine Damond from the press, even when they are the victims of these atrocities here. So with that, how is it that we can stop this terrible, unnecessary division among the sexes and the races?
Honestly, it's one reason why I'm running for office. You know, I feel free to actually say the truth and to say what I think about this stuff. I will call out the left for, I think, fomenting all of these fake divisions. Like, I don't think there's an epidemic of police brutality in America. I think, you know, the police have a really hard job to do. Most do it extraordinarily well. Sometimes things don't go right, and we should, you know, look into that and discipline officers. But most good police departments already do, you know, and it's that doesn't really happen. And when it does happen, it doesn't happen across racial lines. You know, the left would have you think that police are out there hunting black people, and that's just not the case. It's just not the case. And so you have to have, I think, messengers who will actually stand up for the police and who will actually stand up for the rule of law, right? Applied neutrally without respect to people's, you know, race or gender or whatever. And you actually have to have some discipline and look at the data. You know, I find this in gun control debates all the time. I'm a big Second Amendment guy. I have a lot of guns. I'm running against Mark Kelly, who's a gun grabber. He wants to take away people's AR-15s. And there's only like 300 rifle murders every year in America. And you can say that's 300 too many, and fair enough, everyone's a tragedy. But in a nation of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people with hundreds and hundreds of millions of guns, it's actually shockingly rare, right? Rifle murders. And so if you care about gun crime, fine, but it's all handguns. And then there's two specific sub problems. One is mental health and suicide, which, you know, Republicans get made fun of every time a tragedy happens and we say, well, that's mental health, that wasn't the gun, that was someone went psychotic and we should figure out like what's causing that. But that's actually the, you know, a huge component of firearm deaths from handguns. And then the second is basically gang related crime, right? And look at what's happening on the streets of Chicago. This is mostly young black men killing mostly young black men, and Democrats appear not to care about it at all. But if you controlled for gang-related crime and suicide, all of a sudden the gun violence problem goes away. And there's something similar, you know, with how the left talks about police brutality. So, got to run people who are unafraid to say the truth. And because that's the only way we're going to actually solve some of our problems, right? If we can actually agree on what the problems are. And you've got to run people and encourage the population at large to push back on that convenient bullet point that CNN wants to feed you. And actually look at the charts that you just brought up, you know, but how many people do that? How many people feel safe doing that? What kind of government list do you get on by Googling for those charts? And for how long will those charts be available? Like, those are the questions, unfortunately, I think we need to be asking ourselves today. So my attitude and what I learned from President Trump, you know, in 2016 and subsequently is just say the truth and see what happens. But I think that's the only way we get out of some of this slide into to madness that we're experiencing.
Thank you to everyone for watching the Libertarian Institute and Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Mr. Masters, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Keith, great to see you. Thank you.